You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Garth Brooks. Not in studio, by the way, just so everybody knows. Hate to start a riot here in Southern California. But joining me right now is about to retire on terminal leave, which is pretty, I don't know that you can get closer, but Josh Brooks joins us from Washington, D.C. Josh, first of all, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, first of all, thanks for doing this. I probably, like a lot of people, over the course of the weekend, gets frustrating the more ridiculous stuff that you see put out there for the American people to consume as people, you know, watch the news coming out of the Western Pacific relative to the USS Fitzgerald. And so I wanted to have a surface warfare officer on to kind of explain how a ship works. And as is our custom, we won't speculate into what specifically happened to the Fitzgerald, but just want to make people smart about how a United States naval warship operates 24 hours a day when they're at sea. And so, honestly, I really appreciate you coming on and doing this.
Absolutely. And so, the usual disclaimer applies that these are my opinions and not the opinions of the Navy or the Department of Defense. Right. But that said, so let's talk about...
Well, let's talk about you first real quick.
Sure, absolutely.
Get a little thumbnail from you. Born and raised where?
Right around Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, really? You don't talk like a hillbilly? What's up with that?
I seem to have lost that accent, if you will.
Could you revert to it really quick if you went down and watched the Memphis Tigers play a little football or basketball?
I think I probably could.
You know, it's really interesting the way they do that. All right, so yeah. Born and raised in Memphis, where do you go to college? How does the Navy get on your radar?
So, University of Memphis, and they have a Navy ROTC program there, and I was, lucky enough that basically the Navy, picked up the bill for college. You know, at the time I, wanted to fly, but then, my eyeballs weren't perfect at the time, and, this was before it was legitimate to have, eyeball surgery and fly.
Right.
So, went on driving ships, and then...
Okay, let me ask you a couple of important questions. One, did Top Gun have anything to do with it?
No, not really.
Okay, all right, just checking, because that is somewhat of a religious experience for some of the dorks that fly. Trust me, I know a bunch of them that are F-18 pilots in the Marine Corps, and they deny it, and then they start quoting the movie, and then you have Bushido violations, and so it's an interesting discussion. A Marine, recently retired colonel by the name of Duffy White, who's a Memphis guy?
I do not. No, that does not ring a bell.
Okay. All right.
But believe it or not, back to Top Gun. So Cary McGillis' character in Top Gun, the blonde lady, right?
Yeah, you bet.
She was modeled after a real life person named Christine Fox, who was an analyst at Top Gun when they were shooting the movie. I worked for Christine a couple of years ago, and she was the acting deputy secretary of defense, believe it or not.
That's not nearly as glamorous as Kelly McGillis.
That's right, but still.
But still. And just so you know, that movie was filmed on the Top Gun of the Pacific Fleet, otherwise known to the rest of you as the USS Ranger, CV-61.
Right.
For those of you who are not all the way up on your Top Gun trivia. So you have a choice to make after you learn you can't fly, because you got to pay that money back somehow.
That's right.
How do you, a lot of things you can do in the Navy. Why, how did you get into being a surface warfare officer?
I don't know. I think it was just blind luck at the time. And so, we ended up, from Memphis moving out to Pearl Harbor. And I did two tours out there. Did, you know, my first tour on the USS Cromlin, which was a frigate at the time, and then moved over to be the navigator on USS Chosin. And then from there, a couple years later, I did the WEPS, you know, the weapons officer and then the combat systems officer tours on USS Shiloh. And then fast forward a couple years, and I was the executive officer on USS Wayne Meyer, which was a, you know, brand new Arleigh Burke class destroyer, you know, same type of ship that we're talking about here with Fitzgerald. Right. But I was on the pre-commissioning crew. So, you know, we went up to Bath, Maine to the shipyard and, you know, assembled the crew from scratch, if you will, and then, you know, brought her back around to San Diego.
Wow.
And so, you know, those are my bona fides from ship time, if you will.
Okay. The and again, so it explain to us, I guess, can you talk to us, like, generally, ship operates a destroyer at sea, operates 24 hours a day.
That's correct.
How does it do that?
So it depends upon the condition that you're in. So, right. You know, if I am in a bad place in the world where I think I'm going to get shot at, you know, I will have more and different watch standards than, you know, if I'm just, you know, cruising off the coast of Southern California. You know, the ships in Japan, the four deployed naval forces, you know, are usually kind of in a mix of that. You know, they're not off the coast of Yemen or something like that. But so let's just talk through briefly, you know, the different elements of a ship that will be manned 24/7, the people that are there, who's in charge, and what these folks are doing.
Perfect.
So starting down in the engineering plant, you know, we have the engineering officer of the watch, or we say the EOW. Who's in charge of the propulsion and electrical generation, systems for the ship. That person is typically going to be a chief petty officer, you know, an E7, maybe a first class petty officer, an E6, or it could be, you know, a junior officer, maybe a Lieutenant JG or something like that. He's got a couple of folks working for them, right there, you know, supervising the engineering plant, you know, but they're not really involved in what's going on around them, you know, outside of the skin of the ship. You know, they're focused on making sure that, you know, the engines are working right and dealing with any problems.
Got it.
On from there, we have a guy that's called the CSAO, which is the combat systems officer of the watch, who is typically, again, going to be a chief petty officer or maybe a limited duty officer type guy who is supervising all of the folks that are operating the radars and the electronics and then coordinating the repairs and maintenance of any of that kind of gear. On from there, we have, you know, a radio room, which in this case was flooded, where there's a radio watch supervisor plus a couple of guys. Again, that is manned 24/7. They're not doing just, you know, the radio gear, but they also own all the computer networks since, you know, on and off shift coordination and communication is as much by email and chat as right. It is by actual radio these days. Going on from there, we have the Combat Information Center, or CIC, those are the guys whose job it is to, you know, coordinate the warfighting functions of the ship. Now, in a situation like this where, you know, Fitzgerald was, you know, steaming independently, not in any kind of threat environment, those guys are, their job really is to be providing backup to the bridge and helping them understand the picture around them, if you will, where the other ships are and everything. So, you know, in a higher threat environment, CIC is ran by a guy who's the tactical action officer, the TAO. That is normally a senior lieutenant or lieutenant commander who has the keys and the authority to launch missiles in a defensive manner, you know, should that be necessary. I don't know how Fitzgerald was manned. It is definitely possible that there was not a TAO in CIC, given the fact where they were, you know, geographically.
Can I ask you a question about that? I spent time when I was on the Ranger, both on the bridge and then NCIC. In CIC on a carrier, you know, we prosecuted, and again, this is off the, this is headed towards Gonzo Station or on Gonzo Station off the coast of Iran, a lot of times at general quarters. We essentially were prosecuting the surface plot and what was physically around the ship. If you're not in a situation, if you're just in a situation where you're transiting peaceful waters, would that function be transferred to the bridge in terms of, you know, just prosecuting? And when I say prosecuting, what I mean is identifying every track that you have. What is it? Which direction is it? Is it, and accounting for it as you move? Would that function be transferred to the bridge and not in CIC?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
It would not be. So the bridge and CIC are working together on that. But essentially, it helps. So without a TAO, the guy in charge of CIC would be this, what we call the CICLO, or the CIC watch officer. Again, that can range from a first-class petty officer, you know, or a chief, you know, sometimes an LDO. Somebody who's been around. Typically, these guys are operations specialist ratings, the OSs, you know, who spend their entire Navy career, you know, working in CIC, you know, tracking things on radar, figuring out what they are, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So, you know, you got a CICLO down there. There's a CIC watch supervisor who is kind of coordinating things. And then functionally, CIC kind of gets split into two pieces. There's the, you know, the air alley that we say, and then the surface alley. So you've got a group of guys whose job it is to track, identify, airplanes. And then you've got a, you know, another set of guys whose job it is to track, identify, ships. So there's going to be a guy called SWCC, who's the surface warfare coordinator, who is talking to the bridge generally directly, you know, and giving them recommendations on, you know, maneuvers that are necessary to, you know, to avoid any commercial shipping, that kind of thing. And then he generally has a guy working for him who's called the track super, the track supervisor. And that's the guy who's, no kidding, looking at the radar scope and making sure that he's tagging, you know, all the radar contacts that he sees. So that and then from there, you know, the system, the Aegis combat system will, you know, automatically track these ships and, you know, and it display them in the other, you know, displays that are throughout the ship, if you will.
That are linked to his display. I've got an email question for you about that, if you will.
Sure.
Matt, question for you this morning. I am familiar with aircraft squawking, if you will. Do ships squawk?
So that's, and actually, believe it or not, I was going to get to that. So,
all right.
There's a system called AIS, which is the Automatic Identification System, that is required by international conventions to be used on every ship above a certain size. And I don't remember what that size is off the top of my head. It's not huge, right?
Right.
So most commercial ships out there, And so this is a transponder. It's receiving GPS, and then it transmits a signal electronically over the bridge-to-bridge radio circuits that includes the ship's name, their IMO number, which is kind of like their license plate number, if you will, along with, you know, their course and speed and the, you know, the port that they are destined for and everything. So it's kind of like IFF, except it actually has a lot more information. But, you know, commercial ships are both transmitting AIS, and they're also receiving AIS tracks, and generally those are automatically incorporated into their radar displays. Okay, so, you know, you're looking at a scope, and you see little blips, but if all the AIS gear is configured automatically and working correctly, then you see all the other ships around you. You see their position, course, and speed, and a symbol with a speed leader on it, and you can click on it, and you can see their name, which makes it, you know, fairly easy to call them up on the radio because you know who you're talking to already.
Right.
Now, as a matter of policy, U.S. Navy ships do not transmit AIS. Because, you know, and the idea being behind, well, there's enough data there for somebody to shoot a missile at you, really. You know, that's one of the things that we do not do. So we're talking about an early bird class destroyer. And if you notice on those things, you know, the sides of the ship are not straight. They're angled all over the place. The reason that ship is designed that way is to have a low radar cross-section to make it hard for the enemy to find you. So you put those two things together, and it works very well, by the way. An early bird class destroyer on a radar gives a very small return. By design, that's the way it's supposed to work.
Okay.
So, but you put that together with a low radar cross-section combined with a ship who is not, as a matter of policy, transmitting AIS data, you know, one can imagine how it would be difficult for the crew on the merchant ship to not see them, especially if, you know, they were perhaps more reliant on seeing AIS tracks than they were in, you know, looking out the window and, you know, looking at their radar returns carefully. So that's just one of the kind of the complicating factors that, you know, could possibly be into all of this is the fact that, you know, this AIS part of the equation. And we know that the merchant ship was transmitting AIS because, you know, people have already got posted all over the internet. You can see that track.
Right, the track.
You know, of that ship.
Well,
there are, you know, a number of satellites that actually receive, you know, all of this AIS data that's being transmitted all over the world. And so, you know, there's all kinds of sites you can go to and see the, you know, the tracks of all kinds of merchant ships in almost real time.
My guest this morning is freshly retired Navy commander, surface warfare guy from Memphis, Tennessee. That's not actually the home of Elvis, but Elvis, you know, did retire there. So we're probably not going to get to that today, but another time. His name is Josh Brooks. Josh, a couple emails for you. One, hey, Mac, I only rode in the bowels of the Gator, but I used to watch the crew on a pretty regular basis. And then as you're on those things, you become friends with guys that are your peers, in my case, chiefs. It was routine, according to them, when these kind of ships were at sea, for them to throw it on autopilot and for there to be nobody on the bridge. Is that, in fact, true?
So that is not true.
Your experience.
I cannot imagine a situation where that would ever happen.
For a tanker... not an American warship, but a seagoing, you know, a cargo ship or a container ship to be on autopilot with nobody on the bridge.
They could be on autopilot.
Right.
But that's just, you know, the ship will automatically follow a course through the water. I mean, Navy ships have autopilot as well, but there's going to be people there. And in fact, you know, if a merchant ship were configured like that, where nobody was on the bridge, that would be illegal. Okay, so international law for conduct of ships at sea require all vessels to maintain lookout by sight and sound at all times. Okay, that's the driver, if you will, on a U.S. warship of why you have three lookouts generally: a port, starboard, and an aft lookout. You know, like you were talking about, you know, talking with those guys when you're on a ship, and those guys are talking to the guys in CIC, so they're talking directly to the track supervisor, you know, to help him put together the visuals of what they're seeing around the ship with the electronic picture that they're seeing down in CIC. So, you know, you've got those guys right there who are fusing that data, if you will, to build a coherent picture of what's going on around it.
Okay, I've got another email. One of the things I've read over the course of the weekend is on a ship of 300, there might have been six people awake. Now, I know that's true, Could your guest give us some sense in terms of these different departments, how many people would be awake? And I'm also curious about, in addition to the radar, I know there has to be humans that are either on the bridge or on the exterior part of the ship in what I, as a Marine, would call the crow's nest.
Right. So let's talk about who's on the bridge first real quick. So there'll be the guy who's the officer of the deck, who is the CO's, you know, representative. The CO can't be on the bridge at all the time.
Right.
The OD, or the officer of the deck, will typically be something along the lines of a second tour division officer. So this guy is a senior lieutenant JG or a lieutenant, normally. Working for him is going to be a person called the junior officer of the deck, who is possibly somebody who's under instruction, who is, you know, doing more of the day-to-day tasks, if you will. There also may be a conning officer, the conning officer responsible for giving orders to the helmsman. The junior officer of the deck and the conning officer could be, in fact, the same person. There's a guy who's the boatswain mate of the watch, who's, you know, typically a second or third class petty officer who is coordinating the enlisted watch standards. The three lookouts that we talked about earlier are working directly for the boatswain mate of the watch. There's a quartermaster of the watch who's in charge of plotting the ship's position and in, you know, keeping the navigation picture, you know, straight, if you will. There will be a helmsman who is actually, you know, physically driving the ship. He's not making any decisions. Okay. The officer of the deck, the conning officer, is going to give him orders, and it's his job to do those, to turn the ship's wheel, to maneuver the throttles. Now, there's also a guy that we call Bright Bridge, and this is going to be another operations specialist who, again, has one of those same Aegis consoles that they have down in CIC. And he's talking on his headset to all the folks that are down in CIC. And again, he's got the same console. He sees all the same tracks. He has all the same information, so that the guys in the bridge have direct access to that same data that's going on down in CIC. And, you know, if they want to, you can walk back there and just look right at the scope and see all that same information that is, that CIC, through these different watch standards, through both eyeballs, through hearing, through electronic warfare sensors, from, you know, the ship's different radars, is putting all this information together, and it's available for you right there on the bridge. Now, that's from the, in addition to that, generally there's another radar up there, and the guys in the bridge have their own radar equipment up there. So, that generally about six folks on the bridge is correct, but then if we go down to CIC, we're probably going to find 8 to 10 guys. If we go down to radio, we're going to find 3 or 4. If we go down to the combat systems officer to watch, we'll probably find half a dozen different guys here or there. And if we go down to engineering, we're, again, probably, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 guys, depending on what's going on. So to say that only six folks out of the entire ship's crew is awake is kind of misleading. I mean, yeah, there could only be six guys on the bridge, but there's also all those folks in CIC who are backing them up. And then, you know, the guys all around the ships who are keeping the electronics working, who are keeping the engines running, who are keeping the water being made, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And let's not forget that, you know, in just a little while, the supply guys are going to get up and start breaking out food for breakfast. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would categorically reject the notion that there are only six people awake on that ship.
Yeah, my sense is that at night, when you're not in close to combat operations or any type of contingency, that you're probably looking at maybe a near 25% of the ship is doing something between, you know, the bosun's guys doing work on the ship that they can't do during the day. You know, as you said, cooks, you know, different people moving around the ship. I want to go back to the I think you call them lookouts.
Yes.
Are they physically on the interior of the ship looking out, or are they on the exterior of the ship? Does that depend on weather? How are they configured? Because what you're describing is this redundant system
Absolutely.
That allows a warship to operate, you know, safely at night, at 24 hours a day. So talk to us about the lookouts and their role, and are these the guys we see that are using the signaling, light and, using the flags? Are those guys that we see on the exterior of the ship?
They are not those guys doing signal work. So again, back to the, international conduct for ships at sea, what we call the SOLAS conventions, required to maintain a lookout by both sight and sound. So we interpret that, because the bridge is closed, that we need to have people outside. Okay, so you'll have a guy on the port and starboard bridge wing, okay, who are physically outside of the ship. They've got a pair of binoculars. And then you've got a guy on the stern of the ship, the aft lookout, again, who's got a pair of binoculars, and all three of these guys have communications with the bridge and CIC to report what they're seeing. And, now to be fair, if you're a very young person in the Navy, getting assigned as a lookout is probably one of the very early jobs that you are going to have. Right. So, these are going to be, E2s, E3s in the Navy. And, it's an important job, but it's not necessarily the most complicated thing that there is. But again, those guys will always be there. Now, could you pull your lookouts inside if the weather is really, really heavy? Yes, you could, and sometimes we do. If you're in a bad storm or something like that, you might pull the lookouts into the bridge, and you might pull your aft lookout into the helo control tower on the ship, where he's got a still all three of those folks have a visual, the ability to see their assigned sector, if you will, to report what's going on.
Talk to me. So how do they communicate? Back in the day when I did it, it was sound-powered phones. It was the thing that went over your ears, and then that thing that's just that kind of rubber cup that sat right in front of your mouth, that you hit a button, and you could communicate to anybody who was linked into the system. How do they communicate?
So the modern ships have a system called IVIX, which is the Interior Voice Communication System, which has many different circuits, if you will, throughout the ship that you connect into. The port and starboard lookouts generally actually have a wireless, a hands-free box, a little speaker box that's sitting right next to them there on the bridge wing, where they can hear, without having to have something covering their ears, which would impede their ability to hear. And then, they have just a little button where they can press and talk. Generally they're talking directly to the track supervisor, down in CIC.
Right.
Telling him what they're seeing, and then that guy's looking at the radar scope going, okay, yeah, I see that. That makes sense. And then conversely, if the track supervisor is seeing a radar contact, he's asking the lookouts, hey, what do you see at, 9 o'clock, relative? Tell me what's going on out there.
And so really you can see the redundant systems, the number of people that are on board a ship. And again, I was on an aircraft carrier, but this is a destroyer. The radar array that's up, and all the different ways that a ship, navigates itself, whether during day or at night, 24
right.
hours a day while at sea. Before we switch to damage control, are there any other pieces, Josh, that maybe an infantry officer aren't smart enough to ask you about the way the ship kind of comes together and drives itself?
No, that's really the kind of the big picture. I mean, all these folks are talking, they have common resources where they're all providing, bits of information and then building this common picture that, again, is shared, throughout the ship, so everybody, can see everything coming together. And I do not, I haven't seen anything on Fitzgerald, but I will say generically that, when these kinds of things happen, it does not usually come down to one guy made a mistake. Right. It goes along the lines of what we call the Swiss cheese theory, if you will, of, you know, this one person did something wrong and this other piece of equipment wasn't working correctly and this other guy was late and this other guy was tired and, you know, all these different small, you know, errors line up, if you will. And sometimes when you take 8 or 10 pieces of Swiss cheese and blame on top of each other, the holes line up, you know, and kind of, you know, allow that bad thing to happen.
Right. But again, this, the other thing, you know, is, I mean, this is rare. You know, you do not see this happen very often for all the reasons that you pointed out, these redundant systems and essentially, you know, having done it, you're staring at that surface plot, or at least that's what I used to do. And you're just prosecuting every contact that comes up and accounting for that as you move through the night, you know, on your way to do whatever you do. And the things that get your attention are, the vessels that are out there that are not identified, that are not squawking. And whether it's an aircraft or a ship, those are the things that get your attention. And then you begin to investigate those and pay attention to those kind of things. But that is the monotony of every night at sea, as you work the night shift. Yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Talk to us about, and again, my guest very graciously this morning is Josh Brooks, newly retiring commander of the United States Navy, surface warfare officer with a ton of experience, a career's worth of experience. And Josh, where are you living now?
In Manassas, Virginia, outside of D.C.
All right. How's the weather there today? Going to be muggy and nasty?
Not too bad at all.
Not that I'm biased. Okay. The talk to us about the next on whenever you see a mishap like this, the next nightmare is going from a ship that's operating maybe with 25% of its crew, 20 to 25% of its crew up and awake, to general quarters, collision alarm, you know, maybe being sounded, general quarters, you know, going to, and now the ship is damaged, it's taken on water, power and communications become difficult. Talk about the challenges of trying to do damage control in that environment, and how are sailors trained, all sailors trained in damage control?
So we talked earlier about, you know, depending upon the threat environment that we're in, you know, that will kind of dictate the different manning levels of the ship. The ship will have what's called general quarters, which is basically the highest state of readiness that the ship can be in, where almost every single person on the crew will have a general quarters station, whether that's in bridge or that's in CIC, or if it's in one of the repair lockers, being the spread out areas of the ship where we have all the equipment that you use to do damage control. So, you know, things to, you know, plug up leaks, things to pump water out of the ship, things to cut through, you know, damaged metal, you know, firefighting equipment, air breathing equipment for folks to be able to go into spaces filled with smoke, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there are generally three repair lockers on the ship, and the actions of those three repair lockers will be coordinated through the damage control assistant, or the DCA.
Right.
And that happens back in that same space, you know, that the engineering officer of the watch is back there. So the difficult part of this is you never know how much power you're going to have, how much communications you're going to have. And so we routinely set that up and design all of that. So we're still able to do that with basically no lights and no electronics. So we will still have big, you know, paper printouts of, you know, diagrams of all the ship compartments and everything that you can, you know, write on with a grease pencil, and everything to keep track of what's going on, you know, where the damage is and everything. You know, the unfortunate part of this incident is, you know, it looks like there was a very significant hole punched in the side of the ship below the water lines. You know, the, I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of a merchant ship or even an aircraft carrier out of the water, you know, has this protruding bulbous bow thing, which makes the ship more fuel efficient. But, you know, in a collision like this, if this giant, you know, 15 or 20 foot, you know, battering ram, if you will, that punched a giant hole in the side of the ship. Unfortunately, right in the vicinity of two berthing areas.
So the picture that you see is the damage caused by what you see out of the water on a container ship that hits another ship, and then that protruding object. What is it called?
It's called a bulbous bow.
You know what? God love the Navy, right? The bulbous bow that hits below the water line, so you don't even see that damage in any of the pictures, yes?
That's correct. And in fact, most cruisers and destroyers don't have those because they have a sonar dome down there. And the bulbous bow doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Because of the sonar dome. But aircraft carriers and oilers and I believe most of the amphibs as well, you know, have this bulbous bow, which again is something that makes the ship more fuel efficient. You know, and just, I'm not a naval architect, so I don't understand the particular hydrodynamics, but it's a, you know, it's a function of ship design to increase, you know, the fuel efficiency of the ship. But, you know, below the water, you've got this, you know, giant protruding battering ram looking thing almost, if you will, that in this particular situation, you know, you saw the damage above the water line. Which looked like it basically crushed the CO's cabin and such, in some areas right there. But, you know, the real damage, was below the water line. You had massive water intrusion into somewhere around, you know, those forward two berthing areas, which would have had around 40 or so folks in each one of them. And then, you know, radar or radio, the ship's radio is right there in that same vicinity.
I've got an email question. Mac, I'm curious, where is the captain of the ship at this time? Where is the XO of the ship at this time? And could your guest explain that? So where is the, you just mentioned the CO is at sea quarters. So could you talk about import at sea quarters? And I don't know if that's just a function of an aircraft carrier because we had more space, or is every ship configured like that?
Yeah, so generally the CO will have an import cabin, which is, you know, larger and has enough space in it to do, you know, hold meetings and such like that. And then he will have an at sea cabin, which is very close to the bridge, but also very, very small, if you will, especially on a destroyer. So there's a couple different layouts on the destroyers, and I'm not familiar right off the top of my head, with how Fitzgerald was laid out because, you know, we have a couple different variants of the Arleigh Burke class, and this was just done a little bit differently. I would have to get, you know, the ship was here on the starboard side. The CO's at in port cabin is on the starboard side there. But, and, you know, typically, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, the you know, the XO and the CO were probably both asleep.
Okay.
Because the officer of the deck is in charge of the ship. He's the CO's representative at that time.
Right.
Now, the CO will have a series of standing orders. And one of those standing orders will typically be, and I don't know Fitzgerald,
right,
would be if there's a ship that is going to pass within a certain distance of our ship, okay, then you call me and you wake me up and you give me a contact report in a standardized format that describes the crossing relationships between these two ships and you tell me what you're going to do about it. So, that could, you know, a typical number that COs use could be 10,000 yards or 5 nautical miles. It says, okay, you know, I don't care what time of day or night it is. you know, if there's a ship that's going to come within 5 miles of our ship, then you, you know, figure it out and you give me a call in sufficient time that the CO has the ability to say, okay, that sounds like a great plan, or says, hold on, I'll be right there.
Got it. The another email question. Mac, if this container ship was running with its lights off for whatever reason, maybe a malfunction, and I've read that it was a clear night, is it capable of being seen by a U.S. naval warship? So just for the sake of discussion, something that big at night, again, I don't know the moon, I don't know, you know, when moonrise and set was that night, but typically anything that, something that big, would that be seen by a lookout? And I guess a personal question, at night, are they wearing, the guys on the exterior of the ship, are they wearing night vision goggles, or are they using eyeballs or a combination?
Eyeballs. They are not typically using night vision.
Okay.
Now, if perhaps one were in a higher threat environment where you thought the bad guys could be running around without their lights off, then of course you would break out the night vision gear. But it would be highly unusual to encounter a merchant ship running without. In fact, I can't ever remember seeing one. Running at night without lights on, but then again, the radar cross section of a container ship, you know, is
pretty huge,
humongous. I mean, this is going to be a big old fat blip on the radar.
Right.
And then again, I don't know the configuration of the radars.
Right.
Something could have been broken. Stuff could have been down for maintenance. You know, who knows? Those are all things that the investigating officer will have to sort out.
Okay.
But you know, generically, you have three radars on a ship like that that can easily detect a vessel of that size.
Another email. Hey, Mac, just want to say thank you to Josh. I've been listening over the course of the weekends to the different idiots that have rolled out attempting to profess that they know something. I've yet to hear anybody that has the detailed information of the operating environment like Josh. I think it's one of the reasons that we listen to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this morning. It certainly painted a picture in which we can all better understand the situation that night. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the damage control. What would have been the first order of business relative to saving the ship? Is it life-saving? Is it setting the watertight seal around the affected area? How exactly does that work? It must have been absolute chaos as those guys attempted to do that and then organize that chaos as the minutes went by. So how does that, so in terms of damage control, what is the priority of work?
So one of the very important things that happens when you sound general quarters, when everybody is going to their GQ station, is they are reconfiguring the ship, okay, for maximum watertight integrity, okay? So they're dropping hatches, they're closing doors, they are reconfiguring valves to isolate, you know, different parts of the, you know, the fire main system, the chill water systems that are providing, you know, cooling water to the electronics. You are reconfiguring the entire ship, you know, on the fly, if you will, you know, for maximum combat effectiveness and maximum survival. You know, that's one of the things that you do, you know, when those guys are running to their GQ station is, you know, they know that along the way that, you know, it's my job to shut this valve, to close that door, to, you know, to get everything done. And in this situation, I mean, it's hard to know, you know, without the understanding the extent of the damage here.
Right.
But, you know, those berthing compartments are most likely already the hatches were dropped. And so just the scuttle, you know, the round, you know, trap door, if you will, in the middle of the hatch was the only thing that was open. So that's the last thing that had to happen to, you know, to seal off those berthing compartments is to just close those scuttles. And, you know, quite frankly, it's kind of amazing to me that, you know, you've got those two berthing areas that may have flooded very, very quickly with, you know, 40 folks or so in each one of them, that almost everybody was able to get out of there and then get those sealed off.
So part of the story probably is that given the time when it happened, given the severity of the damage, that the casualty toll wasn't much higher.
And again, absolutely.
Again, not knowing, but again, when you loosely consider the parameters of it, so now you're what condition are you setting? Yoke, zebra? What condition are you setting at that point? And so all these things are happening simultaneously, where nobody really knows what just happened. You know, did you?
Yeah. No, they are setting zebra, so they are configuring the ship for, you know, maximum survivability. And, you know, and I got, you know, wasn't there, don't have the information, right. But the tough thing I had to imagine would be, you know, making that decision to close those scuttles to those berthing areas.
Right.
You know, and quite frankly, not knowing that everybody got out of there, but knowing that, you know, if I don't shut these hatches, that the ship could continue to flood and you could lose the whole damn thing.
So around the affected compartment, everybody hears the alarm go off and then the call to set condition zebra. So, and again, for those of you who haven't been on a ship, there's hatches that, you know, have a big, you know, Z on it. So, you know, it's a zebra hatch, and everybody knows what to do because you exercise damage control capabilities on probably a weekly basis when you're at sea. There's drills going on and you're exercising those muscles. And so everybody's doing that around the ship in this particular area. The people that are there, and as in any affected area by damage control, you are trying to get everybody out of there and then close that thing down, while maximizing the number of lives you save. And then that's the drama that plays in around any affected area. And I remember seeing, I think most of us have seen, the fire on the Forrestal. Also the aircraft catching on fire on the, I think it was the Ranger. No, it was the Forrestal when you see the damage control guys go out there time after time after time and explosions occurring. But damage control is a big deal, in the Navy. And then once that happens, Josh, is you begin to set it and you're pretty sure that you've got as many people that are alive out of there as you can, then what happens? Now you're trying to save the ship. Now that you're trying to ascertain damage, what are you doing?
Oh, well, it's all of the above. And so, you know, those ships are built to be able to flood a certain number of compartments and still, you know, still remain afloat, still have stability, if you will. And, you know, so they flooded these two berthing areas. I think one of the forward machinery spaces was flooded as well. But then again, you know, we have that stuff split up into different spaces. It's, again, that concept of redundancy, you know, that you talked about earlier. You know, so, you know, with a hole that size in the side of the ship, there's nothing that you can do to deal with it besides, you know, closing off the space. You know, we have, you know, damage control concepts like shoring and stuff like that to try and to patch up holes. There's no way you have the ability to deal with it, you know, a 15 or 20 foot hole inside of the ship at sea, especially below the waterline. So, you know, really what those guys had to be focused on was, okay, we know we have a certain number of compartments that have major hull breaches. We get those compartments locked down and sealed up as best as possible. Okay. And then you've probably got, you know, some water, you know, coming into other spaces in the ship, you know, in a less dramatic fashion, because right. There had to be cracks and stuff like that
right.
along the hull. So you're dealing with, you know, pumping that water out. And then, such as you can, you know, dealing with trying to you know, to, you know, plug those leaks, if you will, that are into, you know, spaces of the ship that are not, you know, heavily flooded as well.
And that's the ongoing fight. So the initial fight is you close off what you have to close off, to keep the flooding from spreading, and then the other adjacent damage that might be minor still affecting you, you go about shoring that up.
Yeah, you're shoring it up. You're driving wooden blocks into these cracks in the steel to try and keep the water out. You know, all these kinds of things, and then using the different, you've got portable and installed, dewatering systems. You've got pumps and inductors and all that kind of gear. Setting up that gear, using the installed gear. And then, on top of that, you've got to be able to, reconfigure the propulsion systems and everything so we can, still have some power to get the ship back into port if at all possible, which it appears that they were able to do that. So, now you're into, okay, I've got to understand what the damage is to my different, electrical systems. What load centers, what electrical panels have I lost? What do I still have?
Right.
What cooling water have I lost? What do I still have? What parts of the ship am I still able to control remotely? Or, maybe some things, I've lost the ability to talk to the piece of gear, but it will still operate if I put somebody down there to operate it manually. So now I've got to figure out, what do I still have and how can I operate it so that I can get the ship into, back to safety. So that's the, on top of the, the damage control, it's, figuring out, okay, what can I still work and how can I do it? How do I reconfigure the ship using what I've got left to get myself back to safety?
My guest this morning is very graciously Josh Brooks, a career surface warfare officer of the United States Navy. And first of all, Josh, I want to thank you again for coming on and helping us understand a lot of the things that we don't understand. So thank you very much. I got one more email question, and then I'll ask you the general question, and then I'll let you go.
Okay.
The email question is, Mac, how does this ship get repaired? Will it go to dry dock to be repaired? If you're in your assessment, this damage below the waterline, wow. Something we can't even see, and the damage above the waterline was substantial. How does it get fixed? So, Josh, how does it get fixed?
So I saw on CNN that she was headed towards, that they were putting her, they got her back to Japan,
right,
and that they were going to put her in one of the dry docks there in the ship repair facility in Japan.
Okay.
Dry docking a damaged ship is a complicated and dangerous process, which, will take some time. From there, they could repair her in Japan. They also could lift the ship back on a heavy lift ship, much like when we saw the coal come back after she got hit. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
They put her up on the deck of a big heavy lift, ship that could physically lift the entire ship out of the water. So there's definitely the possibility that they would, put her on a heavy lift ship, put Fitzgerald on a heavy lift ship, lift her out of the water, and bring her back to the States to be repaired.
Got it. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want to make sure that people know?
I think you asked all the right questions. Unfortunately, it's almost like, driving on the interstate, or something like that, and inevitably, as thousands of vehicles, pass each other, something's going to break or somebody's going to make a mistake or a combination of those factors. And, and these things just happen sometimes. And, you do have to remember that, you've got, 100 Navy ships, operating around the world 24 hours a day, and something like this happens every decade or so in loose terms. You know, it is a rare occurrence, but, you know, unfortunately, it's just the way life works sometimes that, you know, we inevitably, sooner or later, you know, the luck runs out and some, you know, the stars align in a poor manner, if you will.
Got it. So, in terms of what is next, determination made on the best manner to repair the Fitzgerald, and then the investigation, multiple investigations go forward, looking at the ship and obviously the activity at the crew of the crew, and then the investigation takes its own path.
Yeah, and it'll take a while to sort all that out. But you know, we, especially when there is a loss of life involved,
yeah,
you can be absolutely sure that there will be a thorough and exhaustive investigation into every single possible, you know, contributing factor that went on. And, you know, the Navy will get to the bottom of this. I can guarantee you that.
Right. The sad part is whenever this kind of stuff happens is, the grief of families often spills out and it will be marquee news across the country. I mean, it was the story over the course of the weekend here in the United States. And so, you know, you'll hear, whether it be accusations, I think by, and this is just my sense based on what I've seen in the past, from family members and stories that will be, attributed to, or not attributed to, or attributed to anonymous sources on the ship itself. And so you'll see things written about. So I hope you don't mind if and when, hopefully those things won't, but if and when they do, if you don't mind coming back and making us smarter on those things, certainly enjoyed the visit, and sadly, we may need to do it again, but thanks very much this morning, Josh. It's a pleasure meeting you, and awesome professional job relative to making us the rest of us smart about the surface community and how you guys do what you do and how you guys function around the world with the greatest Navy on the planet.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity. I certainly appreciate it.
All right, bud. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. That is Josh Brooks, newly retired commander, United States Navy. And so our thanks for doing that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Joey Perazzo is going to join us. We are going to talk about an F-18 shooting down an SU-22 in the skies of Syria, air-to-air combat. And then the Russians with a statement this morning, Joey, an F-18 pilot. So we'll do a little bit more explaining as the United States military in action around the planet. More of that coming up next. And again, my thanks to Kerry Cosentini for introducing me to Josh Brooks. So more of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. battlemug.com.